introduction. Hi, my name is Sven, and I welcome you to the presentation of continuous scatterplots. I did this work together with Daniel Weisskopf at the Universität Stuttgart in Germany. So, first of all, let me give you some background information so that you know a bit about the context where we could make use of those continuous scatterplots. So, imagine if you want to visualize a multivariate data set, then quite a successful way of doing this is using a combination of InfoVis and SciVis techniques. Now, such a perfect example for such a system is the SIMBA system, which is described in the paper by Dolaisch et al. And you can see a screenshot down here of the system. So on the right-hand side, in the black background, you can see the SciVis part, which consists of a volume rendering. And on the left-hand side, we can see the InfoVis part, which shows scatterplots, histograms, and so on. Okay, so let's have a look at a scatterplot. What we see here is a typical example, but it's a really easy one. And in a real-world data set, usually we have hundreds of thousands or even hundreds of millions of these glyphs that we see here. So sooner or later, we run into the problem of overdrawing. And this is one of the reasons why we want to use continuous scatterplots instead of the normal ones. So to overcome this overdraw problem, we propose that we do not want to draw opaque glyphs, but instead we want to draw the density just everywhere in the scatterplot domain. And another reason for using our version of scatterplots is that we want to directly make use of the continuous data, which is typical for a SciVis application. Now, to show you what I mean, let's have a look at a typical scatterplot. So what we see here is a very low resolution data set of the Hurricane Isabel. And I don't want to go into details here, just have a look at how it looks like. Now, when we increase the resolution of this data set, we can see that the scatterplot becomes much more accurate and the gaps begin to fill up. Now, if we could increase the resolution up to infinity, then we would get a continuous scatterplot, which looks like this one here. So, this is just so that you know what I'm talking about. And now I would like to give you an outline for the rest of my talk. So, of course, we cannot increase the resolution up to infinity, but we can handle this problem in a mathematical way. And I will describe the mathematical model first that we use to construct those continuous scatterplots. And since this model is quite a generic one, I would like to show you two typical cases so that we can plug in actual numbers. And once we have done this, I can show you the algorithm, basically the implementation that we created to draw these continuous scatterplots. And afterwards, I would like to show you more results for more data sets. And in the end, I would like to compare conventional scatterplots with continuous ones in the conclusion. So, we start with the mathematical model, and whenever I talk about math, I should define the terminology so that we all know what I'm talking about. First of all, we have to identify two different domains. So, a typical SciVis data set is given as a set of data samples which are stored at 2D or 3D spatial positions. And therefore, we call this domain the spatial domain. You can see an illustration of this domain on the left-hand side. Now, on the other hand, the scatterplot shows the additional data dimensions which are given in the input data set, and therefore we call the scatterplot domain the data domain. Now, these additional data dimensions can be represented mathematically by a mapping that we call tau. So this mapping tau maps the data from the spatial domain to the data domain. And in order to construct a continuous scatterplot, all we have to get is a density function sigma, which returns for every location in the data domain the density at that location. So, of course, such a density function would depend on the mapping tau. Okay, so much about this. Now, here's the basic idea that we are following. We start with conventional scatterplots, and just as I did in the very beginning of my talk, we, in our mind, we increase the resolution up to infinity until we have an infinitely dense sampled data set. Now, here are a few statements that we have to make. First of all, we say that the spatial density in the spatial domain is uniform, so we can just set it to 1. And since the mapping of tau does not change the number of data points during this mapping step, we can say that we can use an idea which you may probably know from physics, and which is called mass conservation. Now, this mass conservation idea is the beginning for our approach. So first of all, we can compute the mass in the spatial domain for a small volume V that you can see over here. And for this volume V, we are integrating over the known density function S in the spatial domain, this one here. Now, we can, now that we say that since the, this mass conservation says we have the same mass in the data domain, we can compute the same mass for a small volume phi in the data domain, and this time we have to integrate over the unknown density function sigma. Now you may have mentioned, you may have noticed that for the spatial domain we use Latin characters, and for the corresponding variables in the data domain we use the Greek letters. So you can easily identify the variables if you keep this in mind. Now, beginning from this, we can use the transformation theorem for integrals to get this equation here. And when we have a close look at this one here, we can see that the terms which are marked in green, those are the known terms. So the only thing that we have to get is the density function sigma, which is marked in red. Now, since we say that the integrals are the same, we can say that the integrands must be the same as well. And in this way, we can just shuffle the terms around a bit, and then we have directly computed the density function sigma, right? And then we're done. Well, not really, because this transformation theorem only works when we have the same dimensionality for both domains. And, well, I can say this is basically never the time. This never happens. So we have to come up with a different solution here. And what we do is we follow an approach which is similar to co-area computation. And what I mean with this, I'll show you in this example. So what we see here on the left-hand side is a 2D spatial domain, and on the right-hand side, a 1D data domain. And when we pick a location in the data domain, this corresponds to an isoline on the left-hand side that you can see here now. Now, when we consider a small interval in the data domain, this corresponds to the bent strip on the left-hand side, which is outlined by the red stippled lines. And what we do now is we split the integration, we split the volume into two parts. The first part is the space along the isoline, and the second part is the space which is perpendicular to the isoline at all times. So this is the normal space. And the cool thing about this normal space is that the dimensionality is the same as in the data domain. So within this normal space, we can use the transformation theorem again. And once we have this, we can integrate along the isoline to get the final overall density. So expressed in a formula, it looks like this. So the term which is marked in blue is the density which we have computed in the normal space, which is indicated down here by this small blue line here. And then afterwards we have to integrate along the isoline, which is marked here by the yellow integral. And by doing this, we have a generic formula that works for all kind of dimensionalities. Now let's have a look at a typical case. So for this case, we have a look at a 3D spatial domain and a 1D histogram. And now we can plug in actual numbers into our formula. So 3 minus 1, we have 2D integral. And the volume measure down here can be computed by computing the gradient or the magnitude of the gradient. Now, as it turns out, this expression can be found in the paper by Carr et al. Actually, it's similar to the expression that we can find in the Carr paper, because they do not take into account the density transformations that we have to do for our applications. But what is really nice is that there is a follow-up paper by Scheidegger et al., which will be presented tomorrow. And the cool thing about this paper is that they have exactly the same expression as we do. So this is a nice confirmation that we might be not too wrong after all. Now, the next example here, let's have a look at a 3D spatial domain and a 2D scatter plot. So this is probably an even more important case, since it happens more often. This time again, we can plug in actual numbers. We have a 1D integral, and the volume measure down here is computed by computing the magnitude of the cross product of the gradients. Now, why a cross product? Let's have a look at an example again. So you can see here on the left-hand side a 3D spatial domain, and on the right-hand side a 2D data domain. Now, when we pick a location in the data domain again, this time it results in two isolines in the spatial domain. Now, let's consider a small volume around this location in the data domain, and this corresponds to the two red strips which are outlined on the left-hand side. Now, what we want to compute is the volume measure, which is shown here, and this area can be computed by computing the cross product of the gradients. So this is the reason why we do this. Okay, so We know now what we have to do in order to implement this approach. And we did this for tetrahedral meshes. Now, the advantage of a tetrahedral mesh is that we can compute the overall density based on a linear model. That means we can compute the density for one tetrahedron and for the next one and for all of them individually. And the overall density is computed by taking the linear superposition of all contributions. So that means all we have to do is we have to find the density for one single tetrahedron. And we do this, and we exploit the linearity of barycentric interpolation, because this leads to a few statements. The first first one is that isosurfaces within such a tetrahedron are planes, and the intersection of those isosurfaces is a straight line. And the gradient within such a cell is constant, and this means that the volume measure is constant as well. So I've placed the volume measure down here again, so you can see when the gradients are constant, the volume measure is as well. Now, how do we compute the density for one single tetrahedron? This is done in two steps. The first step is that we have to compute the length of the intersection of the two isosurfaces, and afterwards we divide this value by the constant volume measure to get the overall density for this tetrahedron. Okay, so let's have a look at the first step. How do we compute the length of the intersection? We adopt here an approach which is quite similar to the projected tetrahedra approach, which is described in the Shirley and Tuckman paper. And what we do is we project a tetrahedron from the spatial domain to the data domain and have a look at the footprint that we get over there. You can see an example down here. So here we have a tetrahedron in the spatial domain, and in the data domain we can basically have two different footprints. So either the four points are located here as a triangle and the fourth point lies in the center, or we get a shape that looks like this one here, where we have all four points at the edges. Now what we have to do is we have to compute the density in the center, which is marked here by a red cross in the respective footprint. So what we have to do is we have to find the length of the intersection, which you can see indicated, which is indicated here. So it is the distance between the point P and P prime. And what we have to do is we have to find the position of P prime in the spatial domain. And we do this by computing the barycentric coordinates of P prime in the data domain, and then we use these barycentric coordinates in the spatial domain to compute the actual location of P prime, and then we can just compute the distance. And this value is then divided by the constant volume measure to get the overall density for this tetrahedron. Now, you can see that the density in, these tetrahedrons here is increasing linearly from the edges where it is zero to the middle where it has its maximum value. Now, on the edges we have zero values because you can see right away that the density or the geometric depth at the corners of this tetrahedron must be zero at all times. It's just a zero length. And therefore we can make use of the scanline conversion, because when we attach color values to the triangles in the data domain, scanline conversion automatically does this linear interpolation for us. So we do not have to take care about this. Okay, so this is the algorithm as a wrap up. First of all, we classify the tetrahedron based on its shape in the data domain. So this is described in the projected tetrahedra paper. And then we attach the additional data dimensions and interpret them as 2D geometric locations in the data domain. Then we determine the volume measure and compute the distance, just as I described before on the previous slide. And afterwards, once we have attached all these values to our triangles, we just render them all. And as I said, we can use the linear superposition of all contributions. So we just render all triangles for every tetrahedron in the dataset, and we just enable additive blending to get the final overall density. Now, we can have a look at some examples here. So you may notice from this is the first example again, but this time I would like to mention that we have a really low resolution that you can see down here. So it's a small data set, and when we go to the next one, you can see that the resolution increased quite a bit. And what I would like to show you here is that the scatter plot becomes much more accurate when we increase the resolution. So even when we take a low resolution data set and create a continuous scatter plot, then this continuous scatter plot represents the data set much better than even a higher resolution version using a conventional scatter plot. And we put these scatter plots into a system where we can do some brushing and linking, so we can actually test this. So what you can see here is constant air pressure of this Hurricane Isabel data set, and the blue isosurface shows now all these data samples where we have constant air pressure and varying temperature over the whole range. And we can do some more brushing, which is shown here. So for example, when we brush all the values which have negative values, negative pressure values, you can see that the data samples are exclusively located in the center of the hurricane. So this is just a bit like a proof of concept that our scatterplot works in the system. Okay, another data set is the Blunt-Finn data set, and in this data set we have a tetrahedral grid, and the cell size varies quite a bit in this data set. Now what we see here is a conventional scatterplot, and well, here we have this problem of choosing the right parameter for a scatterplot, because some of the dots are too small in the upper area here. So there are points still here, but it's hard to see them. Now, when we change to the continuous version, you can see the scatterplot much better, and actually you can see even more structures, especially in this area down here. So you did not see these structures in the conventional scatterplot at all, but we can see them in our version because we take into account the cell shape and the cell size by computing the gradient and taking this into account. So let me come to the conclusion. So I would like to compare discrete or conventional scatterplots with our continuous version. So as you saw on the Blunt-Finn dataset, especially we have this problem of choosing the right parameters for a conventional scatterplot, which is, for example, the glyph size. So when we make the glyphs too big, we have this overdraw problem. When we make them too small, we might not notice them at all. And this cannot happen for our version because we have a parameter-free version, and we do not have these problems. The next thing is that you saw in the Hurricane Isabel dataset, our scatterplot is basically resolution independent. So you get the same result, or at least close, a very similar result for all kinds of resolutions, whereas scatterplots for different dataset resolutions just look different. Now, of course, our scatterplot is not perfect, so of course it only works for continuous datasets. This is some sort of a limitation, okay? Well, it was defined for continuous datasets only, but it is a limitation, I have to admit, because a conventional scatterplot works for all kinds of data types. Now, another thing that I have to mention here is that a conventional scatterplot is really super easy and fast and simple to create, whereas our scatterplot it needs some time to compute all these equations that I showed you, and this can vary a bit depending on the data type, data set size. And the next thing is that you can basically see how the density of the input data set changes the sampling density when you have a look at a conventional scatterplot. So this was, for example, best seen in the Blunt-Finn dataset. Whereas in our version, we just take into account the uniform density, and therefore we cannot see those changes in sampling density. And this leads me to the future work already, because we could include this density control, since it is implemented in our mathematical model, but we did not do this yet. And of course, we only did implement our model for a tetrahedral mesh, so we could use linear interpolation, but what do we do when you cannot use linear interpolation anymore? So we have to come up with a different solution here. And what we could do as well is we could compare actual results from our continuous scatterplot with conventional versions to see how big the differences really are. And of course, we could also include our continuous scatterplot into further sample applications to see how useful they are and if they are accepted by users. Okay, so that's all from me. Thanks for listening, and if you have questions, I'll try my best.
If anybody has any questions, please use one of the two mics.
I'm Carlos Schadiger, grad student in Utah. This is beautiful, great. Thanks. Pictures. I was wondering if, you know, one of the nice things about when you have continuous functions is that you can do things like take derivatives and isosurfaces of those on the data domain. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you have an idea of what an isosurface of something on the data domain would look like back in the spatial domain, and if that would be at all informative for the users, because it would enclose these regions of high density, essentially, I think.
So your question is how it would look like in the spatial domain?
Yeah, it's more of a, I'm just wondering what those would look like. If you brushed an isosurface of constant density on the data domain, can these have sort of a meaningful sense on the spatial domain?
That's a good question. Well, actually, I didn't try this yet.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Another quick question.
Yeah.
Are you going to make this open source?
Sorry?
Are you going to publish this code so that everyone else can use?
That's not planned yet, but we can talk about this.
Okay, I have a question. It would be really interesting to take the continuous scatter plot and reduce the resolution with polygons that are in the direction of the gradients and put it on top of the original scatter plot to give mm-hmm. a sense of the flow.
Mm-hmm.
And that might actually lend itself to a potential application to non-continuous data.
Okay. Well, thanks for the hint.